Maybe before I launch into talking about our work, I'd just like to hear maybe just from a few people if you had any particular reflections on the meditation that we did together, if anything struck you about it. I'll explain as I get into the talk a little bit about the approach that we take to meditation and the way we integrate it into our work with people recovering from addiction, but just wonder, yeah. Yeah, apparently.
I'm kind of embarrassed to say what I'm going to say, but what was kind of coming to me during it was thinking about the populations that I've worked with that have addictive disorders. I cannot imagine them sitting for a total of 1 minute.
A total of what?
Of 1 minute.
Of 1 minute, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that one of the adjustments that we did make, it was a pilot study, and we went through a kind of development of the intervention, and we did actually find that shortening the length of meditation was helpful. And I think a sort of, and you probably got a little taste of this in the meditation, the way I approach it and we approach it in our work, is that the pointer is to kind of recognize that there's the doing of meditation, and then there's the recognition that meditation is ordinary awareness that's ongoing. And so it's not simply what we do if we sit for X amount of time in some kind of formal practice. And that becomes kind of a real key to recognize that as some of the traditions call it, kind of the ultimate medicine that is awareness, or this ground awareness, is not only present in moments of formal sitting, it's present. Well, it's ever present. And so, and the last thing I'd say about that is that, like most groups of people, probably not just addicts, there's a pretty wide range of how easy or difficult it is for people to just be still. But generally, we weren't working with people like methamphetamine addicts, let's say, or something. We were working with people recovering, two studies, one with recovering alcoholics and one with people trying to quit smoking. So those were our addictions, and we didn't really encounter too much difficulty with that. So, but any other comments? Uh-huh.
What was the first poem that you read?
It was from a book that I wrote a couple years ago. I can't remember which one was the first one. I read The Groundless Ground, yeah. Kind of touches on the sort of paradoxical nature of awareness. It's not solid, but it's actually the most solid thing that there is, even though there's nothing there that's, you know, concrete. So it's the groundless ground. Okay. Well, why don't we just jump in? My favorite quotes, purportedly from the Buddha, that also touch on sort of the approach to meditation that we take. Interesting, huh? So our work has focused on relapse, really, which is the big problem in addiction. Lots of treatments are pretty successful, but just about, you know, the vast majority of people, almost across all addictive disorders, relapse at some point. So that's what we are really trying to address, and this just touches on, you know, data from one particular study that showed, you know, majority of people still drinking even after successful treatment. Same you see with smokers. If any of you have ever tried to quit smoking, you know all about relapse. It's very common. So the kind of model that we developed our work based on was this notion that there's a lot of scientific support for that. One of the principal reasons that any of us might opt to use some substance that alters our mood state, whether we're, you know, full-blown addicts or if we're just doing that in our life, is it's a way of self-medicating. It's a way of managing something that is experienced as aversive or distressing. We don't like the mood state we're in, and we want to change it, to put it very simply. So this is kind of fancier ways of saying that. But basically, people's challenge regulating their affect or the distress that they experience has been identified as a major factor underlying addiction and alcohol dependence in this case. And one of the most common reasons that people say they relapsed, they were going through a divorce or they were experiencing a lot of stress in their life. Or, like, I would bet right now, you know, with the financial crisis that we're under, you probably are seeing rising rates of substance use and abuse, right? So it would stand to reason. And these are just sort of examples of some studies just noting these relationships between depression and mood disorders and the prediction of relapse, people suffering from various addictions. So based on that model, we developed an intervention, and in this case it was centered around meditative inquiry and meditative practice as essentially an alternative strategy, although it's kind of a non-strategy strategy, for dealing with distress rather than using substances. So this is just, again, just this general sense that, and there's some evidence also in animal studies that stress is strongly associated with relapse and addiction. You know, this notion of self-medication is kind of captured in this cute little cartoon. It was a bleak period in my life. Martinis helped a little. And that's that sense, you know, and we talked a lot about this in our groups with people, that this is part of the power of mood-altering substances, is they really work quite well, don't they? They really do change mood, sometimes instantly. So they help. If you don't like the mood you're in, they're a helpful strategy to change that mood, but it often comes at a pretty high price. So our intervention that we developed falls sort of generally in this category of new interventions and new approaches to therapy and working with addiction in this case. So some people have termed a third wave of behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. And the real key point here, and I'll be touching on this kind of thread a lot in the talk, has to do with acceptance. And if you look at most approaches to dealing, most approaches in psychology in general and therapy are really focused on changing what you're experiencing in some way. Changing the way you think, changing the way you feel. Makes a lot of sense. You know, I don't like what I'm thinking and I don't like what I'm feeling. I want to be different. And so we enter into some kind of approach or technique or strategy to alter that in some way. But what's emerging now, and mindfulness-based approaches represent one aspect of this, is an emphasis on cultivation of greater acceptance of our experience rather than locking us into this notion that we need to control our experience and change what we experience as unwanted internal events. So the paradox is that the transformational nature of these approaches is that often the acceptance of distress has profoundly transformational impact on that distress. Without trying to change it, it actually, you know, Tibetans have a term that when conditioning meets emptiness, it self-liberates. That when things that are arising in the form of conditioned reactions, when they're touched by the emptiness of awareness or the empty ground, those arisings, they self-liberate without having to do anything about them. And if you notice, I mean, that's sort of the nature of thoughts and feelings, as they arise and they pass away, quite naturally, don't they? I mean, nothing, you know, sort of one of the central tenets, of course, right, of Buddhism and other contemplative traditions is nothing remains. So there's a sense in these approaches of if you actually leave experience alone, that has a transformational impact on it. Let's talk a little bit about acceptance. And we encounter this a lot in our work, that people confuse acceptance with a kind of passivity, or even more so a kind of strategy where you sort of convince yourself to evaluate your experience more positively, talk yourself into feeling okay about what's happening. And this is really, really, what we're talking about in our work is very, very different from that. And it's really different, I would say, from what I would call psychological acceptance, a kind of retraining of your mind, if you will, to accept your experience. As valuable as I think that can be, what we're talking about is a little bit different than that. Marsha Linehan created a form of therapy called dialectical behavior therapy, which falls within this third wave of approaches. And I like what she says here about acceptance. The unrivaled entering into reality as it is, as it exists. So again, it's a little bit, the flavor is more of seeing things as they are rather than this kind of positive evaluation, which is how people ordinarily think of acceptance, and is one reason I sometimes don't end up using that word as much, because it has too much of a kind of connotative aspect to it. This is from Jon Kabat-Zinn. Acceptance takes in and responds to how things actually are underneath how they may appear to be, and any preferences or aversions we might be harboring for how things should be. We talk a lot about shoulds in our classes, and that notion that the mind generates that something should be other than it is in terms of our own experience is ultimately at the root of human suffering. As I say here, that resistance to our own experience, the struggle that we engage in with our own internal experience, what we sometimes call the inner weather, thoughts, feelings, and sensations, as well as outer circumstances, is really what creates suffering. It's a teacher, Joan Tolleson, a nice quote. It's the illusion that something needs to be different. You know, interestingly, there's a term in psychology, if those of you who are psychologists or researchers may have heard, which is emotion regulation or affect regulation. And it really is seen as sort of a goal of effective therapy. And in certain ways, our intervention, and I think some of the tenets of the Buddhist tradition, challenge the entire notion of emotion regulation. Because the assumption there is that, again, you have to do something about the emotional states that you're experiencing. And it's an interesting assumption. But it's one that we sort of call into question in our intervention. Maybe you don't have to do anything about emotional states except experience them. As you can see, what happens when you don't accept experience, you can end up on the psychiatrist's couch. And sometimes, as we all know, it can be the tiniest thing, right? I mean, the tiniest thing, we can move into a kind of relationship to it of non-acceptance or resistance and struggle. So in psychology and psychological research, clinical research, there's a lot of interest in, if you have a particular intervention, what's the mechanism of action? And so I came up with this cute little idea that maybe the mechanism of action in some of these meditation-based interventions is actually more a mechanism of non-action. That the way it works is that you don't do anything. I'll say more about that. So what's interesting is there's some evidence to suggest that in the case of dealing with distress, this is actually often the case, that the effort to try and control and manage states like anxiety often has paradoxical effects, which is it makes anxiety worse. And one part of this, and the theory that I have and others have put forth, is that essentially what happens is that the assumption that one has to change a distressing state like anxiety, it ends up conditioning us more strongly to believe that a state like anxiety actually requires, that it's a problem that requires a solution, rather than just an ordinary aspect of human experience. Steve Hayes, who created acceptance commitment therapy, uses this term experiential avoidance, and it's interesting that the unwillingness to stay in contact with experiences like anxiety is turning out to be a stronger predictor of suffering than the actual experiences themselves. So it's not actually, in this, to say it a little more simply maybe, it's actually not the state, to use anxiety again, of anxiety or fear that causes you suffering. It's the unwillingness to experience it that causes suffering. Because it's just anxiety. It's just fear. It's just a state. Again, kind of talking about the paradoxical effects of management and control of emotional states. So our active coping efforts to minimize an experience like anxiety may actually unintentionally serve to maintain the anxiety, reinforcing the notion that it's undesirable and unmanageable. In other words, something that I have to change. You can see the paradoxical effects here. You know, the old, the don't think about a pink elephant. Like, you actually, you bring the experience, you start to engage in a battle with it, and now you're actually reinforcing the experience in a way. I actually think, as someone who's done meditation for many, many years, I think that many, many meditators engage, without knowing it, oftentimes in a battle with their own conceptual minds. And that actually ends up, in my own experience at least, just generating more agitation, actually. I mean, you're trying to get free of the agitation of the mind, but without realizing it, you're often struggling against that agitation, which is just more mental agitation. It's tricky. I think we probably all know that who've practiced meditation. So it's interesting, they've actually done some studies that seem to suggest that using some of these acceptance-based methods may actually be more effective than some of the control strategies. This was an interesting series of laboratory studies where they people inhaled carbon dioxide, which actually produces a feeling of anxiety in the body. Would you like to volunteer for that study? And so then they did a couple of different approaches. In one condition, which was the change-based approach, people practiced deep breathing, diaphragmatic breathing. So, in other words, they were trying to control their anxiety by, you know, breathe deeply, right? And the other method, they just allowed the experience to be there using mindfulness and acceptance-based kind of approach. And actually, the people who used the acceptance-based approach did much better. The anxiety was less distressing. They've also shown in some studies that one study where you put your hand in ice-cold water, it's called the cold pressor test, and at a certain point after, I don't know, 10 or 15 seconds, it starts to get quite painful. And when actually people accept the sensations, that's the strategy that they use, they can keep their hand in the water for much longer. Pain is much less intense, which may be a little bit of the hint into how why mindfulness-based methods appear to be very helpful for people dealing with chronic pain. That one aspect of that is that people enter into a new relationship with the experience called pain, and the essence of that relationship is one of less struggle and less resistance, more acceptance. Even if pain is still there, it tends to produce less suffering when there's less resistance to it. Again, sort of portraying the difference between classic kind of cognitive behavioral psychotherapeutic techniques and acceptance or mindfulness-based approaches. So one theory is that by allowing and developing, cultivating this attitude of acceptance of internal experiences and difficult experiences, theoretically, that will serve to increase your capacity to actually tolerate strong affect, and then in turn, not have to do something like use a substance to manage it. Because actually, you don't need to anymore. Because you have a greater, you've kind of widened your capacity to actually meet any experience. And one way we describe this to our study participants is that in relationship to difficult experiences, in particular craving, whether say for cigarettes or alcohol, which is an aversive experience. Anyone know that experience of craving, like say with cigarettes? It's not that easy to deal with. So what's one of the easiest ways to relieve craving? Smoke, exactly. And basically, it works quite well. But you could imagine if craving became something that you could actually meet and not have to manage in a certain way, that would reduce the likelihood of returning to some use of some substance to manage it. And as I was saying earlier, and people in our classes, many of them began to discover this, that this new relationship to an experience like craving had the paradoxical effect of changing the experience of craving, actually. It wasn't just like the craving just went on forever, but that relaxation around it and that allowing and acceptance of it actually changed the experience, and the craving, like all experiences, went away. So we talk a lot about shifting from the doing mode, which is I need to do something about craving or stress, instead of, well, maybe you don't have to do anything about it. Maybe you just have to experience it or be with it. Be present with it. There's this notion in psychology of exposure therapy, where when people have particular, say, phobias, you can expose them to, initially in smaller doses, say of heights, if they're afraid of heights. And basically what you're doing is you're deconditioning, you're extinguishing their learned or conditioned response to the phobic stimuli. So one theory about mindfulness is that if we have a conditioned tendency to want to resolve difficult emotional states like anxiety and craving, if you're constantly, in a sense, exposing yourself to them more and more through just being present with them, you're in very likely to be deconditioning or extinguishing the habitual response to it. So this is a question that I've actually never heard anyone ask in all of this work around mindfulness and acceptance. And I think it's actually really, really central. And it touches on the way we teach meditation in our classes and the way I kind of guided you in the meditation that we began with. Most of the time, people enter into this, you know, kind of inquiry or exploration and imagine that, well, I'm going to learn to accept. I'm going to do this. But rarely do we ever ask the question, well, both what is this I that's going to accept, and what is it actually? Is it the mind that becomes more accepting, or the body that becomes more accepting? What aspect of our own existence or our own being is that? What is it that actually accepts? And so what we end up talking and guiding them into is that their own awareness is that which can accept the most difficult experiences and actually does so effortlessly. And so in a way, we're taking it out of their something that they're going to do, and instead, they're going to discover a dimension of their own experience that naturally allows the moment to be as it is. And I don't know how familiar you are with, you know, I think, you know, many of you practice within a particular type of tradition within the Buddhist tradition, but there is precedent for what we're talking about even within the Buddhist tradition, within certain schools of Buddhism that focus on kind of what some people call natural meditation. And I'll say more about that. And so in our intervention that we've developed, which kind of evolved out of my own experiences with meditation and which went through a series of changes over a number of years and understanding of it, and that we de-emphasize concentration and the skills of observation, and instead the real emphasis and focus is basically on the non-manipulation of experience. And in that, we're deconditioning, again, this tendency we have to imagine that certain states are good and others are not. So we call what we do natural mindfulness. As in some of Kabat-Zinn's recent writing, he's been talking a little bit about this, making this distinction between kind of intentional mindfulness or deliberate mindfulness and natural mindfulness, or effortless mindfulness. And that this mindfulness is a mindfulness that's already present before you do anything. It's present right now as the ground that's awake to this moment and aware of this moment. Interestingly, in a lot of, for people know about mindfulness-based stress reduction, if you know about that, that Jon Kabat-Zinn developed many years ago and many, many people are now doing. One thing that they teach in that is that there's certain attitudinal foundations of mindfulness. Some of these qualities are non-striving, letting go, acceptance is another one of the attitudinal foundations. And we teach that a little bit differently in our class. We say that rather than those are qualities that you need to develop or cultivate, those are actually the inherent qualities of ordinary awareness itself. that ordinary awareness is actually, its nature is to allow what is. And we'll sometimes use images to try and capture that, like one that's used in many contemplative traditions, that awareness is like a screen that isn't capable of rejecting any image that appears on it. It doesn't have that capacity. It's receptive by its very nature. It's unconditional in its acceptance. So I use this diagram sometimes to kind of make a distinction between psychological acceptance and what I'm talking about. So let's say you're dealing with something like craving or anxiety or traffic jam, and you might be resisting that experience. Your mind is saying all sorts of things about, God, I wish this wasn't happening right now. When is this going to end? I can't believe this is happening to me again. That's kind of psychological resistance. And then psychological acceptance would be some kind of inner strategy that you use to shift that mind stream in such a way that there's less resistance. And what we're talking about is that there's a ground level of awareness that is essentially holding both of those, psychological acceptance and psychological resistance. But the ground of awareness or acceptance is, as I said before, it's unconditionally accepting. So there's, as we sometimes say, that there's something, even if you're struggling with your experience, it's very easy to hear, and people, no matter how much often I will say to them in the classes, what I'm telling you right now, people will hear it as, oh, I'm struggling with my experience, I need to stop struggling and accept my experience. And that's actually not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying that there's actually something in your experience already that isn't even in resistance to the struggle that's there. And one of the effects of that, and I've seen it directly in my own life and in our, many of our study participants, is that the paradoxical effect of that is that resistance tends to soften naturally when that's noticed, when that's recognized. There's a few quotes here to kind of illustrate a little bit of the spirit in which we teach meditation. This has to do with what I said earlier about going to war against the mind, which can sometimes happen when we enter into this kind of relationship of certain things are distracting and then we bring attention back. But in some ways that can create a notion that certain aspects of experience are not all right. This points to what I was saying, again, this is from a Tibetan teacher. The very nature of the mind is such that if you only leave it in its unaltered and natural state, it will find its true nature, which is bliss and clarity. So take care not to impose anything on the mind or to tax it. When you meditate, there should be no effort to control and no attempt to be peaceful. There's an interesting kind of subtext here that I wanted to just share briefly. There's some controversy within the contemplative traditions around what I'm saying, in the sense that traditionally the concentration practices are considered important preliminary practices before people are pointed in the way that we're pointing them to ordinary awareness. And in some cases, in old traditions, it was like, you know, 20, 30 years before anyone would even, you'd even get to hear that teaching like this. And, of course, this is completely, it's out of the bag now, in a sense. I mean, these kind of direct path teachings, as they're sometimes called, they're available now to anyone. And so we're sort of doing an experiment within an experiment, in the sense that most of the people who come to our classes are totally naive to meditation. They don't have experience doing concentration practices. But we're sort of doing an experiment to see to what degree they can actually start to get a sense of this, through the kind of pointing that we're doing, even without a lot of preliminary practice. In some cases, no preliminary practice. This notion that this stability is actually already present, not something that needs to be cultivated, that awareness by its very nature is stable. I love this quote, kind of that speaks to the non-resistance. forms being everything that's arising, including those things we might resist. I love this quote. Again, it points to that the nature of awareness is this embrace of what is. That's its natural condition. Here, mind is referring to awareness, not that conceptual mind. Well, I'm going to go through these next series of slides to just touch on where our work stands right now. We basically, my collaborator Cassie Veaton and I at California Pacific got a grant about 3 years ago now to develop a pilot intervention to help prevent relapse. In this case, this study was with recovering alcoholics. This gives you a little detail about the grant. No one had really developed such an intervention, so this was really a what they call a development feasibility grant. And we also wanted to look at the effects, obviously, beyond just alcohol use on mood, their ability to handle emotional distress, and the role that increased mindfulness or awareness may be playing in their reductions in relapse. So we developed a provisional treatment manual. We were consulting with other experts, Alan Marlott at the University of Washington being one of them, and then developed a provisional treatment manual. So we first did a feasibility test with two different cohorts in a local substance abuse treatment center. This turned out to be a bit of a disaster. It was a really difficult population to work with. They were quite transient. And the other problem was that they were already receiving so much treatment that their motivation to take part in our pretty intensive intervention, which met once a week for 2 hours and was asking them to do a lot of home practice, was simply too much for them. So we decided to change our, this is also with this group that we noticed that sitting for long periods was difficult. Also, even the length of the class was shortened for this population. And then we also opened it up to the general public and recruited just for people who were in recovery from alcohol dependence, whether or not they were currently receiving treatment. So following this change, we then, this just elaborates upon the difficulties we had with the inpatient treatment program. I don't need to elaborate on that anymore. But after we changed our recruitment strategy, we recruited three cohorts, and it gives you a little sense of who was in the study. One of the challenges we had, which I don't know exactly why, but we had a lot of problems with retention. And some of that was people that actually never even attended the first class, which, unfortunately you end up having to count those people as dropouts in studies, but they never even experienced anything of the groups. My collaborator and I had a kind of a sense that in these groups that we were working with, roughly about a third of the people, their lives were really profoundly transformed through this intervention. Probably about another third of the people feel like, they got some benefit from it. And then another third, there was really like no resonance or connection with what we were offering, and they left. And I think in some ways it's not surprising. I mean, because we're engaging them in a pretty deep inquiry into the nature of consciousness, the nature of who and what they are, and not everyone is necessarily interested in that kind of investigation. In that respect, regard, it really asks quite a lot of them. Nevertheless, for the people who we regarded as study completers, we saw really promising effects of reductions in craving, improvements in mood, less emotional reactivity, decreases in stress, and increases in mindfulness. So all of these changes were significant. And granted, this is a very small study, small numbers of people with no control group, but this is where you start with this kind of a investigation of a new intervention.
Excuse me.
Yes?
Yes.
Yes. Kind of very pretty standard questionnaires that they filled out pre and post. And then we also followed them for 3 months after the intervention. And we saw, as you often do see, because we didn't have any kind of ongoing booster sessions, that there was a drop off in the impact, after 3 months. Interestingly, the drinking behavior data is really quite encouraging. If you look at the mean days abstinent over the course of the study period of 81%, that's actually quite high for relapse prevention studies. So still, there's still drinking behavior going on, obviously. But actually at 6 months, that was our latest follow-up point, 14 of 18 participants reported total abstinence. And as I say here, it compares favorably with other interventions, which is really what we wanted to at least demonstrate, that it was comparable to other interventions. And it remains for future, you know, larger studies, better controlled studies to, you know, demonstrate that it's something that's really a valid intervention and helpful. So we collected a little bit of qualitative data, and I just thought I'd share some of these quotes because I think they're quite striking. There they are. Oops. Will it go backwards? There we go. Or maybe not. All right, one second here. Every motion has a bodily feeling. I can stay with the feeling no matter how pleasant or unpleasant and let it arise and pass with no need to act on the feeling. That's pretty powerful. And someone totally novice to meditation. For me, this was about learning to be all right with whatever thoughts I have, good or bad. Whenever I get stressed, I stand back and recognize the dynamics of the storm of mental activity and can say, whoa, so this is what this feeling is, just a stream of mental events, which I assume to be a true reflection of the world. And then I'm able to let the distressing thoughts dissolve to calm. Pretty good, huh?
Very. Uh-huh. What were they instructed to do? Or were they?
Very good question. I'll just repeat it in case you didn't hear it. She wanted to know what people were instructed to do. Well, let me say two things in response to that. One is we did give them, there were three guided meditations that they practiced with. And two of them were more doing meditations. One was awareness of breath meditation. So it had a concentration component. Another one was kind of a body scan. And then the third meditation was much more of a non-meditation meditation in the sense that the instructions, it was guided in much the same way I guided you into recognizing that there's something that's awake and aware now without your having to do something to make it so. So there's, in a sense, the minute you open your mouth or engage in anything, there's some element of doing. But the direction that we were moving people is in less and less and less striving to arrive anywhere, including a state of concentration. So the emphasis was on non-striving and remaining awake, not falling asleep. It was 8 weeks long. They met once a week, and then they had CDs to practice, do home practice with guided meditations. Uh-huh.
It struck me when we were talking about that last year there was an article in the New York Times called Coping with the Caveman and the Grid. I don't know if you know.
Coping with what?
With the Caveman and the Grid.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you know about it, but it was about, like, one of the best ways to calm and up that baby is for the parent to just, like, recognize, okay, you have this feeling, like, to demonstrate to the child, I understand what you're feeling.
Right.
Uh-huh. And it seems to me like this is exactly what people are doing to their own emotion, like just recognizing it, like this is what you're feeling, and not judging it, and it just calms the person down. And it's funny how it's like the same technique between children.
Mm-hmm. We'll sometimes use, now it's a nice example, we'll sometimes use the metaphor of if you say a powerful emotional state is arising, and let's say it's like a big giant tidal wave, our tendency, our conditioned tendency is to brace ourselves against that, to go into some kind of, essentially struggle to try to escape that experience because it's unpleasant, right? So we invite them to relax that tendency and actually just be with that wave. And then the exploration is see what happens. There's no goal there. Just see what happens. And often, you essentially, those waves cease to be sources of suffering. It's just a wave of experience. And like all experience, it always changes, right? It never stays the same. We sometimes say to people, and it's a funny thing about, you know, we want to try to let go of certain things that we feel like we're holding on to. And I always say to people in the classes, well, the interesting thing about life is it's already done that for you. Because the state's actually already gone. The state that you think you're trying to let go of is already gone. It's kind of interesting. So life's liberating itself. We're trying to get, you know, and that's what it's doing, moment by moment. Everything is passing away, arising and passing away. And it brings enormous relief when you stop, when you just actually stop resisting that, when any of us do. Yes, huh?
The ones who perhaps couldn't tolerate the dysphoria. I work with that population.
Couldn't tolerate what?
I think that mindful acceptance works when you already have perhaps a physical or emotional equanimity that can tolerate the dysphoria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think, I don't know the answer to the question in the sense that, and I don't think anybody does. I mean, part of what your question is are there certain people for whom these kind of approaches may simply not work or be a bad fit? And, you know, it sounds reasonable what you're saying, that there may be those kinds of people that it's too dysphoric, it's too... simply too painful to sit with that level of discomfort and be present with it. And I just don't think we know the answer to that. In the case of the people who left our group, for those who we were able to contact about why they were leaving, that never arose as a, you know, it was just too difficult for me to sit with what was arising. It may have been what happened for some people. I don't know. I have a sense that it's possible for some people that the kind of non-doing emphasis was challenging for some people. That is like people, sometimes when I'm teaching outside of our research, these kinds of things, people will say, well, you know, give me the 10 steps to non-striving. Right. Don't we all do that in some way? Like, tell me how to stop doing. We what's that? See what we do is we apply the doing mode to non-doing, and it just doesn't work. So that's one of the reasons that I emphasize a lot that in the case of being aware, the doing actually literally is not necessary, because you don't have to do anything right in this moment to create awareness. It's spontaneously arising. Now, the little bit of doing is to simply notice that it's spontaneously arising, because it's often overlooked. And, I mean, most people are walking around without conscious awareness of awareness. The other little twist that we use in our in instructions and meditation is to just let awareness be aware, which it's really quite good at doing. Yeah, there was a hand down there. Yeah.
Well, yeah, the argument against that, you very nicely danced on the word acceptance, because that is another teacher is telling you something that, yes, you can do that, but if you want freedom, you have to watch, get down, and see where those habits are formed by cause and effect. You have to observe, and then when those little details are seen, they will release. But there's something.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, there's a particular view. That's a point of view around practice and a particular approach that's considered a prerequisite, if you will, or necessary step to liberation. But there's other traditions that view it differently. That liberation is the natural condition of.
That's another of this teacher's point.
Yeah.
I'll carry that to another question,
yeah.
Which is that's Buddha nature, Buddha mind.
Right.
Which is nowhere in the Buddhist teaching nor in the word acceptance. But that.
Yeah.
The other point is, your 30%. People are different. There are Enneagram types. People have different things. People get enlightened through bhakti practice. People
right. Yeah.
Why does the science get to that?
Why doesn't it get?
I was looking for the center of the bell curve. Why does the science get to the fact that?
You mean the individual differences?
The bell curve, yeah, is not human reality.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, this is very challenging.
No. I think it's a good point. I don't disagree that that say the approach that we're taking is maybe not a good fit for some people. And the position I take, which doesn't work real well for getting stuff like this published, is that, honestly, between you and me, I don't really care that this doesn't work for some people. But I think for some people, there's profound resonance with it, and it's profoundly liberating. So there's a natural attrition, if you will. Some people, you know, there's some people that aren't going to be attracted to this particular path that is represented here in this teaching. And they'll be drawn, as you say, to another path, maybe that emphasizes bhakti practice, or you know what I mean. So we know very little about those individual differences and matching sort of approaches with that. But I think there's a way in which, just in life, people are going to naturally gravitate towards where there's resonance. And you know, I think we take the position oftentimes with these kind of interventions that we should somehow come up with an intervention that's going to work for everybody, or that everyone's going to. And it's nice from a research standpoint, because when you have the dropouts, it sort of ruins the validity of the study in the eyes of scientists, because you don't know about the dropouts. Maybe we're doing really poorly, and so your data are kind of skewed. But I do take the position that it's possible that it was an error on our part that caused them to leave, but it may just be it wasn't for them, you know. I mean, what? Some people aren't interested. Uh huh.
No, I just want to more light.
I was interested if any of the persons you worked with,
yeah,
had they been a part of 12-step programs?
Most of them.
Were they already in there?
Yes.
Because 12-step programs, what I know of them are, you know, the archaic language and things they've been doing for 70 years.
Yeah.
But there was things like let go, let God.
Uh huh.
And some people that do, that does work, and the wisdom to know the difference between, you know,
yeah,
striving and trying to,
right,
and just relaxing. In other words, there's a lot of metaphors in there.
We actually.
That seems so similar to what you.
We actually spoke to that quite a bit in the groups, because most of the people. We did, and because many of them, or most of them, were involved or had been involved in 12 steps. And in fact, the notion of kind of being powerless, we took that and applied it to the approach that we're using, which is, in a sense, your power, what we're talking about, like let's say it's a very aversive state. What I would say to the participants is, you're powerless to accept this. But from the standpoint of this ground awareness, you're also powerless to not accept it. In other words, it's doing that, allowing. Awareness is not pushing away this moment. And so the power of acceptance, it's not in your hand. So we would kind of use that language because it was resonant for many of them around sort of the 12-step notion that they needed help. And whether they put that in the form of a higher power or in our language, the higher power is this natural awareness. Yeah. I'm sorry, was there another comment?
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Very much like
yeah. Yeah.
I'm not responsible, but there is a higher something to
yeah.
handle it for me.
Right.
And in your case, it's a
word. Right. Right. And it's of course, a really key thing, at least in our approach, is that and we started to get into this notion. often this investigation started to lead in the direction of, well, who is the one who's aware, which of course is really central to contemplative practices, even if it wasn't our focus, this kind of self-inquiry. But that question would begin to arise, and for some of them, they would begin to get the sense that that what they actually fundamentally are is this awareness. And in fact, we would even say to them, one way to think about acceptance is it's not something you do, it's actually what you are. That this ground of space of allowing the moment to be as it is our fundamental nature. So we started to delve into that area with them, not too deeply, but some were more or less interested in that. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's very hard to say. Yeah. Yeah. One of the challenges too is that it often can require that someone hang in there a little bit. And I would even say this to them at the beginning, and it often wasn't, you know, gotten or taken in, but I would say, you know, we're asking you to do an experiment, okay? But you can't conclude that there's nothing there unless you do the experiment and look through the microscope, if you want to use that metaphor. And so probably to leave after one class, there's no way they could have possibly known whether there wasn't something there for them. You know, that's why I would make that argument. And I would say, just do the experiment. And after 8 weeks, if you conclude there's not anything here for you, then great. Then there's not. But do the experiment at least. But, you know, plus people have complicated lives, and probably for some of them, they probably went back to drinking early on and felt like, even though we said you could continue to do the class, they might have felt like they didn't want to continue doing it under those circumstances. It's hard to know, because most of those people just didn't want to stay in contact with us once they left, so we weren't able to find out. You had a question back there? By the way, I know we're at 9 and things are supposed to end. I'm happy to stay on and answer questions longer if people want to stick around. So,
Yeah, I'm curious about
the amount of time that people have to be sober. Yeah. We had a lot of variability, and we said that they needed to have had, we changed it a couple of different times in early on. I think it was 2 weeks of or 3 weeks of sobriety that they needed. But, you know, we knew by they were keeping daily logs of whether they were drinking or not. And we knew that there were a number of people who were still actively, you know, they had had that amount and then, you know, had relapsed in the middle of our study. So, I mean, it's an interesting question, like, is there an ideal time to get them? And I bet that varies a lot from person to person. But I'm sure if people have more sobriety under their belts, probably an intervention like this might be easier. Although still, I mean, these people, like I say, I mean, many of them got tremendous benefit out of it, and obviously, and reported that, and they didn't have a lot of sobriety. So I think it can work both ways. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I'm curious if you're familiar with the teachings of Emma Chodron.
Uh-huh.
They seem to resonate very strongly with what
Personally, not that much. I mean, I'm familiar with some of her writings, and I never really studied directly with her. But I mean, I know of her. I kind of know a little bit of the lineage she comes out of, and but it's been less of a direct influence on mine. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Has there been any look to whether it's the meditation itself or another focused distraction?
Can you say more? What do you mean by that?
My professor about this, and basically she was just saying that there's, you know, a lot of research going on. Is it the hours of meditation, or the and also versus what about another like focused distraction? Like, is the aversion to perpetuating the rumination and everything, is that what's helping, or is it like specific meditation?
It's difficult to generalize when you start talking about meditation because the techniques are so varied. And I mean, in some ways, even to compare our findings with even traditional mindfulness-based approaches is a little iffy, considering that we're not emphasizing the concentration part of it. I mean, I've taught MBSR before, and my personal feeling is it's mostly concentration practice that they're doing. And it's obviously, it's very potent. I mean, I know it has a lot of therapeutic benefit to it. There were a few people who had some meditation experience, and they found the kind of natural meditation approach very refreshing in a sense, because they had always found that meditation was a struggle. That had been their experience, and this felt like less of a battle for them and less of a struggle. So it was interesting to hear that. Yes? Right.
Some for 12 steps.
Yeah.
I can imagine even, you know, a really wise person recommending, well, maybe you check out an evangelical Christian, you know, born again. And,
yeah.
You know, they also taught their therapy. My point is that, have you ever thought about doing some kind of survey that could find what people are more exposed to as mindfulness or others?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's interesting. I think that there's lots of different things you can do in your life that bring relief from, right, the angst and the stress of life. I mean, everything from, you know, going on vacation to exercising to being involved in your faith tradition to coming to a meditation group. Like, I mean, there's so many different things we can engage in. And we're looking at a very specific thing, obviously. And it's operating or based, emerging out of a particular theory, both psychological, you say, but I would say more rooted in the contemplative traditions, that awareness, there's something about awareness itself that functions as kind of the ultimate medicine, actually, for meeting the challenges of life. And that's a proposition, if you will. And it isn't to say that other things, you know, aren't helpful in life or enjoyable even. But there's something very specific. The other thing about that is that it's you could say the one universal is that every human being is aware, regardless of what they believe.
Yeah, well, yeah. That
absolutely.
And so you could do studies that could, you know, because you have to admit it's a very small study.
Yeah. Yeah.
Quite large.
Yeah.
So if you could do broad studies to find out how much the population is overall and mindfulness is really the recommended step?
Well, there's a student at Yale right now who's doing a whole study around that. I'm a consultant on her study, but she did some training in mindfulness-based stress reduction with Kabat-Zinn, and one of her observations was just what we observed, which is, you know, not everybody is into this. And it got her curious about why that might be. So she's trying to identify what are sort of internal or external barriers or obstacles to people being naturally interested in this, whether it's just dispositional, personality, life circumstance, cognitive capacity, who knows what. But she's trying to unpack that very important question. No one's ever really looked at it.
So,
yeah. Can you explain what you mean by that? We don't know what the Buddha said, is my own perspective. We don't, actually. How do we know that? Yeah. 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 Well, in the spirit of that, can I leave you with a poem about the Dharma? Is that okay? So this poem is called The Living Dharma. Why cling to some idea or philosophy uttered thousands of years, or maybe just a moment ago? Why, when there is already this explosion of life, would we ever look back? The real Dharma lives here, breathing as this that has never been seen or heard before. This symphony of sounds and sensations right now. The rustle of leaves, the chorus of birds, the ache in my back, the rush of color everywhere. This wondrous mystery of thought, appearing then disappearing like everything else. This is the living Dharma, this timeless presence that welcomes everything that has come before, but is defined by none of it. Every teaching, every tradition, the words you are hearing now, all of them gone, consumed in the fires of this living truth. Thank you all. It's wonderful to be with you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.